to 40 loving dickheads, dreaming about a premiership cup. We love our clubs, but they never win two flags in 100 years.
That shit house,
if you think we'll be insightful, clever, or just well researched, we're here to say that's not the case. We'll just go out and wing it. We are two guys, one cup.
Hello and welcome to Two Guys, One Cup Summer Edition. My name is Charlie Clawson and this series is my club. And this week my guest is Charlie Pickering. You know him as the host of The Weekly. I know him as my former housemate and a mad, keen Bombers supporter. Charlie is a fantastic guest. It took us a long time to tee up this interview. Our schedules kept changing and then our respective children both made us sick at different times, but we finally got there and I think it was worth the wait. Charlie has strong opinions in life, but particularly about the Essendon football team. We get into it straight away. The drug saga, James Heard, what Charlie feels the club's obligation to its members and its supporters are. I think I only ask about four questions in the entire interview because Charlie really takes the ball and runs with it, if you pardon the pun. I thought this was a fascinating chat. So, ladies and gentlemen, here is Charlie Pickering. Charlie, long time in the planning and the making, but we finally coordinated our schedules. I think I first messaged you at the end of last year. And
that is right.
Here we are in March 2021, finally talking about the Bombers.
And so excited to be here. We're recording this at a time when Essendon just went down by 7 points to Geelong in the first match of the preseason. And they kicked, I think, 187 points, I think, by the end of it. Like, the kicking was... But it was one of those... It was a classic preseason match for an Essendon supporter in these times, which is... high-level incompetence, but just enough promise to give some hope that will be destroyed around the mid-season point this year. That's what I'm predicting.
Well, that's what I'm fascinated to talk to you about because, like, here's my impression of Essendon supporters and where Essendon is at the moment. You've seen the movie Trading Places.
Yes.
Dan Aykroyd, super rich, privileged. Mm-hmm. Two billionaires decide to make a bet to see if they can take everything away from him to see if he will turn to a life of crime. He's stripped down, then he realizes that he needs to build himself up with a stronger moral core. Now, I feel like Essendon are at the halfway point of Trading Places where you guys have never known adversity like this. Like my reading of it, like through the drug saga and then, you know, the bounce back seemed to be really quick and you got all these great draft picks in, John Worsfold, but it didn't kind of click. And you can sort of sense this impatience with Bomber supporters to be like, hang on, we are not used to mediocrity. We're not used to this. Like, what's your take on that?
All right. There is a cultural thing with Essendon, and I'm going to trace... No one else you speak to will trace it back to this, right?
Okay.
But I was, like, reliably informed around 1998. Like, someone was talking... We were talking about how some clubs have money and others don't. And someone said to me, well, you know that Essendon still has war bonds from World War II. And it was like, and that was what was said to me. And it was like, it's like they never sold them off and they've still got this asset and it's just like worth an extraordinary amount. Now, I don't even know how war bonds work, but to me, that is the mental picture of Essendon that we've never lacked resources. You know, and particularly in my lifetime, I watched the 83 grand final on TV. And which was appallingly bad against Hawthorn, but I went to 84 and 85. And that was the formative moment of my life watching football, was watching Essendon be just absolutely awesome at playing football, like unstoppably good. And then again, I went to every match of the 2000 season, except the one match they lost to Footscray. So I literally didn't go to watch them lose that season. And so I've known the dominance of this club and I've known them to always bounce back and be in contention. And then a string of appalling decisions have led to the point where we definitely lack confidence as a club. Supporters, we lack confidence in the club. And that is strange for us, but it's entirely justified. Like there should be consequences. You know, you're a St Kilda supporter. There had to be consequences. For a long time, it was like the players could do whatever they wanted. You know, and the club never told them to pull their heads in. And that's why they never were in proper contention. You know, like, well, there are consequences for cultural issues at a club.
I don't know what St Kilda has done. I don't know how many mirrors they've broken or how many gypsies they've run over in their time. But, like, the curse is upon us. I mean, Essendon, it's fascinating. I liken it to what Carlton went through at the end of, you know, the 90s, start of 2000s, when they were sanctioned for basically cheating, you know. And similar, you know, huge Victorian club are suddenly put on the back foot where their draft picks are compromised. Financially, they've taken a massive hit. And there is just this kind of, like, you know, dark cloud, this question mark put over their existing premierships. Now, Carlton, it's 21 years later and Carlton is still, you know, trying to find their feet. I'm not saying that Essendon's rebuild will take as long, but I do sort of see a lot of similarities. Do you agree?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But I think, do you know what, like, as not an Essendon supporter, as a person that is a fan of just justice... Well, fair enough. Like, Carlton cheated. It should be hard for you to come back and win a grand final after doing that. Essendon, like, I don't like getting into... Well, I mean, we had some salary cap stuff as well. We had, like, salary cap issues and we had the peptide scandal.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it should be hard. It shouldn't be easy. The whole reason you have a draft is to try and make the competition more fair. The whole reason you have punishments for breaching salary cap is to try and make the competition fair. And it's, yeah, fair enough that it's hard. But I think that in the mix there are some bad decisions that were made that at both clubs, I would say, that made the comeback harder. You know, if they'd made every decision well... along the way since their disgrace, they probably would have been back in contention sooner.
But on the surface, it didn't seem like you'd made bad decisions. I mean, Will and I in the regular Two Guys, One Cup, I remember, were talking about how smart Essendon had been in, you know, the way they sort of took their punishment. They had that year where most of the players were kind of not allowed to play. And then you seemed to draft really well. You brought in an established, experienced premiership coach. And on the surface, it looked like you were handling it perfectly. You know, you'd really gotten through that period, that bumpy period. But I wonder if there's some psychological scarring that has occurred. Like, if there was something that got into the player's psyche or the board's psyche that meant you just could not gel.
Well, yeah. I mean, do you know what you don't know? You actually don't know what happens to a player who doesn't play for a year. Like that, like, if you... are a guitarist and you don't play guitar for a year, do you ever get back to as good as you were? If you're a footballer and you don't play for a year, and we all know how much the game can change in 12 months, and you don't play, you've missed a step. You know, there are very few players that could take a year off and come back and be as good as they were ever again. Like, that's a really unlikely.
Was there ever a point, you know, at the sort of height of the peptide scandal where you had any doubts about supporting the club, where you felt like, you know, you couldn't endorse them with your membership?
I'd stop paying my membership.
Right. Did you publicly put it in the microwave like people tend to do after a big loss? You know, there's always people uploading social media videos of them microwaving their membership card.
Yeah, but do you know what? You're still a paid-up member regardless of what you do to the card. Like, you know, like you're still... You got to, you know, if it's far less exciting to watch someone cancel the direct debit payment. It's very laborious to do that online, and there's a number of emails involved. It's too long for TikTok. But but no, but for me it wasn't. I wasn't there to publicly punish my club. I just felt that it was wrong for me to continue to financially support a club that, to be honest, at the time just didn't get it. Like, just didn't do it. The whole thing could have been handled better, and we should get into, like, Can I just park this idea? I'd like to talk about James Hurd in a massive way, and this is probably a good way to get into it. So as far as disillusionment goes, that was part of my disillusionment with sport itself. And I'll explain that. I had two sporting heroes throughout my late teenage years and early 20s. I had two sporting heroes, and they were James Hurd and Lance Armstrong. Right? And in the space of about 18 months, they were both taken away from me, and they genuinely changed my relationship to sport. Like, because people I looked up to, people who I had followed as incredible champions, and both of them were about as good at doing the thing as anyone has ever been. You know, Lance Armstrong, technically, I think, is about probably the third or fourth greatest cyclist of all time. But in my lifetime, definitely the greatest. The greatest at riding the Tour de France, absolutely. And James Hird was as good a player as there was at the time or probably ever. And also, and the thing that hurt the most is, and what I liked about him the most, he was, I reckon, the cleanest player going around at the time. Like, I never saw him throw an elbow. I never, you know, he wasn't an eye gouger. He wasn't a squirrel gripper. He was a guy that would go into a pack and come up with the ball every time because just somehow he was better at it. And to have the cleanest player preside over the dirtiest scandal was a very hard thing to swallow.
I firmly believe that his fall from grace is one of the most compelling Australian, if not international, sports stories ever. You could not have a figure who is more beloved or revered or had won as many accolades as James Hird. And every club has this romantic idea of bringing back, you know, their favourite son to coach the club, you know. And often it doesn't work out. Mm. Michael Voss, you know. But James Hird seemed to have the acumen for coaching, you know, and he seemed to have the players. And then this thing happens. And there has never been as dramatic a fall from grace as what happened to James Hird. And I just think it is astounding that that guy, where his reputation was prior to this to where it is now, it's just, I can't think of a bigger 180 turnaround.
Yeah, but I think there's an added element to it that I don't think is discussed. And to be honest, I've wanted to make a documentary about it for a long time, but I don't think you can actually make it without James Hird, and I don't think James Hird is ready to go near a microphone to talk about it for a very long time.
But that's when you can get Scott Dooley in for the reenactment, because I'm still pushing my idea. I've been pitching this telly movie, Charlie.
Hey, Scott.
Bombs away, the peptide
saga. Scott, leave your hair long for three
months.
Right. I need you. Just let your hair grow out a bit. But there is an added element to this story that I don't, that actually takes it into a mythical status for me. It actually becomes like a Greek myth. And it is that his undoing was his greatest strength. And that was his determination to win. And it served him as a player. Like, you have a look at, I remember reading articles in The Age, which is like the Fairfax paper of Melbourne, for those that don't know it, but the broadsheet newspaper of Melbourne, when in the 2000 season, I remember just reading articles which were just about how far he would run in a game. And it was before they had GPS tracking of players, but they'd map it out and they'd go in one play and they would have diagrams of how far he ran and ended up kicking a goal at the end of it. And it was extraordinary how hard he was running, how much ground he was covering. He was involved in the back line, the centre and the forward line. He could go wherever he wanted and do everything. He would always come up with the ball. He famously had his fucking head
caved in.
Sorry, I don't know if you meant to edit this, but
no, that's fine. The show is called Two Guys, One Cup, Charlie. I don't think you have to worry about content.
That incident, he had his head caved in because he was running for a ball to take a mark, had someone running against him, and he dived into the guy's knees because he wanted to take that. And his face was made up of plates. He like physically would never be the same again. Like, his face changed shape. Like, it's one of the most grotesque injuries ever seen in football. All a product of the fact that his desire to win was almost unmatched, you know, in football. He becomes a coach. He has a member of his medical team that he shouldn't have trusted but does. Tells him there's a thing that isn't against the rules. It's not listed as a thing you can't do, but can help the players recover. And he has this desire to win. Now, it was literally not on a list of banned things you weren't allowed to do. He should have thought, oh, hang on, it's definitely not okay to just be injecting players. Like, that's never happened before. Alarm bells should be going off, right? Like,
well, I think one of the thing that is concerning, because I, you know, was quite sympathetic towards him and even the players who were like, well, look, you know, we were just doing what the doctors said. But the fact that it was off the books, the fact that they were going to kind of like injecting houses, that is where red flags should have come up. Yeah, otherwise, they make it transparent.
That was suspect. If it was just if everyone had a booking on the Essendon Google Meets, schedule, like then fine, and it was the in-club doctor doing it. Yeah. So anyway, that definitely had the stink on it. But what I'm saying is, like, he made a terrible decision, which was that his desire to win led him to that decision. But the worst decision he made was when it all came out, if he had fronted the press and said, they were not on the banned substance list, but it was a big mistake, we shouldn't have done it, I throw myself on the mercy of the AFL and I take the punishment and I stand down as coach until this is investigated and resolved, he still would have been seen as a hard done by hero. He would have been a lot more beloved and he would have ridden out the controversy. I think he would have come back as a coach. I genuinely think that would have happened. But his desire to win meant that he hired a QC, meant that he was taking transcripts of every conversation that he was having on the phone, meant that he was going to go to court. He was going to fight it, dragged it on, and he never had that moment where he could just say, I've done the wrong thing and I am sorry. And that is, in my mind, what destroyed him. Mm. And that, to me, is entirely a product of his desire to win. And it's what made him a champion footballer and made him, one of the saddest figures of recent sporting times, if not worldwide, then definitely in Australia. And as a fan of the club, that was too much to bear. And that's why I didn't pay my membership for a few years. And it was hard for me. I didn't go to games. I lost interest in football as a result of it. And that was, football has been a part of my life since I was born. And it was my favourite thing to do. It was the thing that my father and I did when I was young that was an absolute, it was the way we bonded, as a lot of men do. When you're watching something else, so the conversation is easier, and so going to the football with my dad and his friends, as they would get loaded at the football, was just one of my favourite things as a kid. And it was, I think I still grieve what I lost through that scandal.
It's all
because it was all about me.
Yeah. it's really, those childhood memories, like a lot of people that I've spoken to doing this show, talk about how formative those early memories of going to the football with your family or your mum or your dad were. So who was your favourite player as a kid in the 80s? Was it sort of like a Vanderhaar?
Yeah, it was.
Or
Paul Vanderhaar.
Or
Paul Vanderhaar, 100%.
The Flying Dutchman.
And I used to like draw pictures of him at school. In class, if you had to draw anything, I was always drawing Paul Vanderhaar, taking a mark. Paul Salmon as well. I deeply loved Paul Salmon. I played full forward as a kid, because of my height.
Did you?
And
very short team.
Yeah. No, but I was less short when I was young. I don't know. The one thing I had was, and it was the same with cricket, I could catch anything. So I was actually a good forward because I would always take the mark. I could catch anything at any time. That was my one great sporting skill.
I believe the technical term, Charlie, is you're an undersized key position player.
That's exactly right. Lee Matthews wasn't that tall and he was a devastating forward, and Kevin Bartlett wasn't that tall, and other players from a very long time ago.
you're the Lee Matthews of junior football. We'll just put that in a quote.
Yeah, maybe more to use Essendon 85 parlance, maybe more a Daisy Williams sort of dangerous short forward, or a Darren Buick, more a Darren Buick type figure. But
I'm always fascinated by, culture is always a term that comes up a lot. Like, what is the identity of a club? Will and I often talk about, Collingwood, it's always backs against the wall. Whenever Collingwood has, the media and everyone going against them, that's when they'll come out and win against the odds. I mean, if you take that as a kind of barometer, then 2021, they should win the flag. But the culture of Essendon, the way I read it, because as a guy growing up barracking for the Saints in the 80s, I felt harassed and bullied by Carlton supporters, Hawthorn supporters and Essendon supporters, because you were the big boys, the big Victorian teams. But to me, Essendon were the most interesting of those giant clubs because you seem to have this combination of, like, you weren't the silver tails like, you know, Hawthorne or Carlton. You had a bit of that Western suburbs grit, but also with the kind of dominance and, you know, multiple premierships. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's because we were just, I was trying to be glib about it, but I won't. I think you're absolutely right that to be out at Essendon and Windy Hill, even, like I grew up in Brighton, but I was going out to Windy Hill and I culturally was identifying with Windy Hill, you know, like, but so it was by no means, a suburb best known for an airport. Like, it's just funny. Like, there was no sense of privilege at that side of town. It was definitely working class. But there is a thing about success that becomes part of a culture as well. And those two things can absolutely go together when everyone takes it seriously. But, you know, I feel like Essendon, I feel like they were the most professional club the earliest, if that right. makes sense. I think they treated it more like a business than other clubs earlier. And I think that really showed through 2000. It felt like they were running it professionally in a way that other clubs weren't. I think other clubs kind of developed and they've led a bit. Maybe that's, you know, why Peptide seemed an option. It was just the vanguard of professional development. But so I think there was an element of that. But yeah, beyond that, it's funny, and this may be why recent times have been so hard. I think part of the culture was success, and the expectation of success. That's a dangerous thing to have in your cultural makeup. If that success goes away, then your identity is pretty thin at that point. It's funny, you talk about St Kilda. I always had great affection for St Kilda because I lived close to Moorabbin and I was obsessed with football. So I would go, if there was a game on at Moorabbin, I would go. It didn't matter who it was playing. So it could be like Geelong St Kilda and I'd go because I just loved footy. And so I always just had a great sense of camaraderie for St Kilda supporters, particularly throughout that period that they couldn't win a game. Like, they just, that was bad times. And
so the
and
last
the cage,
150 years, is that yeah, what you're talking
no,
about?
But, but you were properly wooden spooning it in like 85, if I recall correctly.
That's
like
totally.
You were wooden spooning hard, you know.
Yeah, seven. I think we won seven wooden spoons in the 80s.
Yeah, you were the Lance Armstrong of wooden spoons. But you know, I had some great times out there at the cage. It was, and that the sound of people beating on that aluminium shitbox of a stadium was pretty. That was a special thing. You know, I never had any affectionate memories associated with Victoria Park, which to me felt
racist?
Regressive. Regressive on almost a like It felt like, you know, in the chart of, the chart of evolution of ape to Cro-Magnon to Homo sapiens. It felt just one step back on that. It just always felt one step back on that chart.
Congratulations, too, on ticking off the two guys, one cup bingo, where every guest has told me that they have a lot of affection for St Kilda, because as I've come to learn during this show, St Kilda is a threat to no one. No one fears St Kilda. No one has a bad memory associated with St Kilda.
No, that's right. You have created no trauma for anyone, you know.
Well, you remember, you know, our mate Dan Austin, who's also a Bomber supporter. I remember one pre-season, there was a practice match between the Bombers and St Kilda at Moorabbin, like a warm-up game. And I said, do you want to come to watch the game with me? He's like, yeah, sure. And as we were stepping off the train and walking towards Moorabbin, he turned to me like quite brightly and was like, you know what? I have absolutely no fear of walking into Moorabbin. Like, it wouldn't be the same if it was going to the Witten Oval or Victoria Park, but I'm actually quite happy to be here. And I'm like, that is the most insulting thing you could ever say
is.
To me.
Oh wow, it's like going back to the Jam Factory and being like, I used to have heaps of fun here as a kid. That's great, love it. I used to come here and saw Santa and told him what I wanted for Christmas. I loved it here. That's great.
So you grew up in an era and you were privileged to at least spend sort of half your footballing life having your club guided by one of the most legendary figures in the AFL in Kevin Sheedy. I mean, do you reflect now on that period, particularly as, you know, you haven't been able to replicate that success and just appreciate what a giant of the game Kevin Sheedy was?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And getting back to the point that the thing I was saying before about how I felt like Essendon were professional before other people. I think Kevin Sheedy saw the big picture before other people.
Yes,
I think he saw 100%. The big picture before the AFL was the AFL. I think he saw the big picture. And to have that as really the heart and soul of your club for 20 years, I think 20 years he coached for, 20 straight years.
Mm.
And through ups and downs, what I will say is I think you would struggle to find another coach in AFL history. I could be wrong. But he took three generations to premierships. Like 84, 85, and that was like a generation of winning. 93, like an unexpected young, like a young team.
The Baby Bombers.
And then was able to absolutely dominate again in 2000. Should have won in 2001. Like it would, like really should have won again in 2001. And should have won in 99. You know, the preliminary final against Carlton was a disgrace. But there should have been three there. But either way, how many coaches over that span of time rebuild three generations of the team and take them to win? That's an incredible experience. And that contribution is huge. I think all of football owes him a debt for the way that he saw the game as big. The way he went to Greater Western Sydney, when he's pretty cooked as a coach at that point. But if you're going to send anywhere to convince them that they should give footy a go...
Yeah,
there was no one better because he just loved footy so much. He would be a duffer for anyone if it meant that people were loving footy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you think back to the early 90s when Sydney were floundering and the AFL basically just dragged out Ron Barassi and said, please, can you just go up there and just sprinkle a bit of your Barass dust on Sydney? And it worked because those guys, they are... like they are the Fabergé eggs of the AFL. And I don't even know if we will see legendary coaches like that anymore. I think that the game
is changing
too much. Do you know
the other example of that, the other example of that that I think is worth bringing up is Blight going to Adelaide. Did the same thing. He was such a respected figure as well. And he made them successful. Like he was a very senior guy by then. I was a massive fan of, you know...
I'm only smiling because, you know, after that, Malcolm Blight then came to St Kilda and we managed to destroy his career, his reputation.
Yeah. The problem was you weren't a new club.
I think the problem was he was happily retired by then. He was living on the Gold Coast playing golf and we paid him $1 million and said, mate, you can just bloody phone into training, and then wondered why it didn't work out.
Yeah, that sounds like such a good strategy. But I think, you know, it's funny, that seems to coincide with the period where it felt to me like the best players at St Kilda were at Transformers nightclub a little too often around the corner from the ground.
Nah, mate, it wasn't Transformers. It was Flaming Moe's in Bentley.
Oh, Flaming Moe's, Flaming Moe's was a Johnny come lately to the equation. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah, players shouldn't own bars while they're playing. No, just not a good idea.
Not.
It's such a bad idea.
So you're kind of spoiled, you know, for your footy journey. Was there one era that you pick over the other? Like, was the 80s or the 90s era? What was your favourite? I mean, I guess the 90s, you're a bit older. You could probably appreciate it a bit more.
Well, I think 2000 was... So I went to every game in 99 and 2000 and 2001. Like, I went to not every interstate game, but about half of them. And so for me, it was, I was old enough and had a job. I was at uni, but I had a job and I was old enough that I could get a cheap flight to go and watch them play interstate. And so that was cool. Like it's either that or 85 were my, like, you know, the years where I was 100% invested. It's all I thought about for the season.
Mm-hmm.
Although that's, you know, and now that I say that, 93 would be my favourite game I've ever been to. You know, like because they weren't certainties. You know, like they were a young team, they were absolute upstarts, and it was a surprise that they won. That would probably be my favourite game. So anyway, that's not an answer to your question in any way whatsoever.
They're all great. I mean, they're all like your children.
Yeah, but I can wax a bit lyrical on, like, 85 for me, there was something special about that bygone era that Billy Duckworth was a truck driver, Paul Vanderhaar dug pools during the week. You know, there was a sense that some of them were definitely having a cigarette at halftime. Mm. You know, there was that era of football, and there was something, you know, that's where the footballer, and it wasn't just Essendon, but that was the era when still the footballer was the working class hero. You know, the Rocky narrative of the guy from the neighbourhood that pulls his boots on the weekend and wins a match. And, it, you know, I just watched a Mark Wahlberg NFL Philadelphia.
Is that the garbage?
Invincible or something.
Is that the garbage? Yeah, that's the garbage player, the garbage man who becomes an NFL player or something?
Yeah, no, he's not a guy. He's a barman.
Oh, right.
You know, like, and he's what? Anyway. Like NFL, and it's good because I like NFL movies. I think NFL is the best sport for movies. It's very it's really good. Baseball's also good, but
yeah,
that is such a fucking digression.
Has there been an Air Bud NFL movie? Because I'll only watch it if it involves a golden retriever.
Do you know what I think? I don't know if there is one where a golden retriever ends up being a wide receiver or running back for the New York Giants, but God, it's got to be possible. I mean, and now that you say it, I think I'm the man to make it. But there are, oh man, it's funny. I've recently, what happened because I got disillusioned by AFL is I got quite into NFL and, mm-hmm. and American football, like college football and American football. So that's become, you know, I now watch as much of that as I do of AFL, which is interesting. You know, just getting back to Kevin Sheedy and coaches generally at Essendon.
Yeah.
If you and you know when I talked about bad decisions leading to like the funk that Essendon is in at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I think there is one bad decision that has cost the club the most over the last 10 years, and it is the moment where there were two, to replace Sheedy, there were two guys going for the job of coaching Essendon. Now, do you know who they were?
Well, one would be Matthew Knights.
Yes. And do you know Matthew Knights, they made the final two, these coaches.
Yeah.
And they made their pitches to the board on the same day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Who do you think the other was?
Well, I think for the way you're setting up the story, the other one would be Alistair Clarkson?
No. Essendon grand final player, halfback line.
Oh, Bomber Thompson.
No.
Oh, okay. Mark Harvey.
Hardwick.
Oh, really?
So on the same day, Matthew Knights of Richmond and Hardwick of Essendon go for the job of coach. They both make a PowerPoint presentation. And by the way, this is just what I've been told. Fact check this all you want, but this is the story that I've been told. They both make a PowerPoint presentation. On the day, Hardwick's laptop gets a virus. He has to borrow someone else's laptop, and he doesn't really know what he's doing. He loads his PowerPoint presentation. It doesn't work. He has to give up on it and do it verbally. So on the day, the board saw Knights have a working PowerPoint presentation and do it right, and Hardwick not be able to operate a laptop. And they went with Knights.
I would love to see Hardwick improvising with sock puppets or something like that. He brings out like salt and pepper shakers, puts them on the boardroom table. So we're going to put the forwards up here and the backs down here. Can I just borrow you a glass of water? Okay.
And do you know what really would piss me off is I know that Hardwick still would have done a great presentation because he will accept the situation and make the best of it no matter what. Like he's we don't have time to bemoan shit guy. He's a get it done guy. Like, and it's just incredible to me that like culturally he was a perfect fit for the club. He was always on the field the most serious guy. Like he was just getting the job done the whole time. No one coaches better than halfbackmen. For some reason, halfbacks know how to coach. Like, you know, they always just come out such great coaches. And so you would say currently, pound for pound, I think the best coach in the AFL. Like if you could pick anyone to coach your team right now, I think it would be him. You know, and Essendon could have had it. And on that, you know, like that little sliding doors moment, They went with Knights, and that was the first time for a number of years we had the wrong coach. And that's where it all started to go downhill.
I felt sorry for Matthew Knights, though, because I felt like there was a little bit of that kind of snooty country club attitude towards Matthew Knights not being an Essendon person. Like, I felt like, I mean, you've gone, he has to follow one of the most legendary coaches of all time, you know, like, that's like your MC or your warm-up guy being like the most legendary comedian, and you know, and then you've got to come out and it's like,
it's Ashton Kutcher replacing Charlie Sheen. You know, impossible job.
I just sort of felt like my read of that was that, I mean, look, Matthew Knights obviously didn't deliver when he should have, but I also felt like the same impatience that you're seeing with Essendon supporters now was being shown back then. Like, it was kind of like, you know, your favorite
You're missing the essential detail, and you don't see this detail. It's staring you in the face, and you're missing it because you don't know the experience of winning a premiership. Okay. And you don't know the experience of winning a premiership, so you can't see it. We were always going to be suspicious of a player who hadn't won a grand final. And I actually think if you were an ex-player becoming a coach, I would always be inclined to listen to a guy who's won some grand finals. You know, I don't know statistically if that bears out and is true, but you know something about what it takes to win.
Well, I think it's a balance of what you were saying before, why good halfbacks make great coaches. Because I think there is an element where someone like a Michael Voss, you know, or a Tim Watson, you know, when Tim Watson went into coaching, because they were so naturally gifted and they have a hard time understanding, well, why can't you just stand on that guy's shoulders and take a grab and then turn around and then wrench it over your shoulder and snap it through the post? But I think if you have a balance of, I think the best kind of, like, this is why I think Lethal was such an amazing coach, because Lethal got every single ounce of talent out of that little short, stocky plumber's Super Mario body, you know? Like, he was not a natural-looking athlete, but he had determined. He was skillful and he was tough, but he had the ability to apply himself. And I think that is something, work ethic, you can train into a group of players.
I think that is it. And I wonder if enough clubs, when they're choosing their coaches, look at that psychological profile in the same way.
Yeah.
Because I do think, I mean, we have experienced this in our lives. Like, you remember this from school. The captain of the football team got treated differently at the school to everyone else. Shane Warne, for his entire life, was treated differently to everyone else. And he may have been great at winning because he was naturally good, but I don't think he's necessarily got grit. Mm. Like, I don't think he necessarily knows what to do when things are hard, because they've never been hard enough. And the truth of the matter is, no matter how good your list is, if you're going to win a grand final, there are going to be times where it's hard and you have to know how to win. You know, the term finding a way to win is kind of one of the most universal things in football, in all forms of football. But, like, the fact is, when nothing's going for you, have you got what it takes to win? Lee Matthews always had it. Hardwick always had it.
And it almost comes back to
Longmire had it.
It comes back to James Hurd, really, in a way, because he wasn't a high draft pick. You know, he didn't on the surface appear to be, like, you know, your star player. But then through, you know, application, determination, a will to win, and obviously, like, the skills and that came later. But he probably was perfectly equipped to become a coach. Football brain.
Yeah, and he wasn't out of the box a champion. He had to make himself that. Mm. It's funny that when he had a run of injuries as a player which went for ages, and it's one of the things that, like, he could have played 350 games and had the greatest stats of all players ever, but he was out injured for a lot of the time, not just having his head caved in. He had, like, these ankle and calf problems. And I remember how he was coming back and he overtrained. Like, it was like he didn't tell the club that he was doing extra running because he was so obsessed with working hard and coming back that he re-injured himself because he was working so hard to come back. It's that thing that you say, like, that mentality of just doing more than everyone else to get there, you know, and I think that's true, you know. And so this is being quite a digression, but I think that's what podcasts are. but yeah, I think,
feel seen.
Yeah. I'm not sure how Essendon's going to go now. like this season. I think there is potential. I think there is always potential. But what there isn't is anyone at the club who still knows what it's like to be successful. And I think that is the challenge, because once you don't have that heritage of winning in the club, that's hard to make from scratch.
Well, that's interesting you should say that, because I think that's where, you know, we were all tricked or fooled, was with, you know, after the kind of sanctions and the players had that year off, and then it seemed to be like Adrian Dodoro seemed to be a friggin' genius, like the players he was bringing in, and he just seemed to, drove such a hard bargain. And if you looked at Essendon's list 3 years ago, you know, you were like, oh, these guys are going to be challenging for the top four real soon, because there was just talent across the board. But something...
And also everyone after they win the first two games would say they're final four. Like they'd play two good games and everyone would say, yep, exactly what we thought. These guys will be there at the end of the year. But you got to play a season. And I just think we had, you know, like we had assistant coaches giving players different advice to the coach. You know, like, and not feeding information back to the top. Like, to just, we had bad communication, bad coaching, bad structures, and no amount of a good list is going to overcome that.
What was your opinion on John Worsfold? Like, do you think that maybe he was a caretaker who was left there too long, or do you think he never got given the support he needed?
I think you have to make him responsible for what he achieved when he was there. And I think he didn't do the job. But part of that, I think, was the problem with, as I say, internal problems with assistant coaches and the way they had decision-making structures set up. But that's the fault of the coach at the end of the day. Like, you know, that's why being an AFL, or being a coach of a football team, is a pretty shit job. But everyone thinks you're a genius when you win. You know, you... I think he has to be responsible for himself. I just don't think... Well, you would have to say, based on the results, he wasn't the right coach to take them to a place to win.
Yeah.
You know, there was at no point... Like, throughout his time, Essendon barely put together four consistent quarters of good football, let alone a season of good football. You know, like... I struggle to think of a game where they performed in every quarter of the game over that time. And, you know, someone could prove me wrong, but my experience was always there'd be a quarter where they'd shit the bed and that'd be it. And you know, it'd either be the first quarter and they could never come back no matter how good they played, or they'd be dominating out of the first quarter and then the third quarter would look like they'd forgotten to come back out onto the ground. And you can't win with that. And that's a failure of everyone. But it's like, you know, that to me is the enduring memory of his tenure, be it whether that's fair or not, you know.
I follow you on Twitter, as everyone should, Charlie. You're very entertaining online. But I saw that you...
Jesus. I retweet a lot of just right on shit. I think that's all I mainly do on Twitter. I retweet a lot. But anyway.
I saw that you were particularly upset with Saad leaving your club at the end of last year. Does that hurt more than Danaher?
Oh, absolutely. Like, absolutely hurts more than Danaher. I mean, I have an emotion, like a nostalgic affection for a Danaher at the club. You know, I watched all of the Danahers play for Essendon. And so I, you know, that I had some affection for that story, but realistically, he was a very expensive injury list player. You know, he didn't play a lot of games. But more importantly for me, Saad was exciting, and Saad made a difference. And there'd be situations where Saad would turn nothing into something, and there were situations where. And it's funny, what I love about Saad is in a game, you know he's going to take on a tackler and try and outrun them probably 6 to 8 times in a game. And he'll get tackled definitely once, probably twice. But 6 times he will break that tackle and run and deliver it to the forward line. And it's exciting football. And it's like he backs himself so much on the field. And he plays a type of football that's exciting, that has an impact. And as a fan, you want that going on. Absolutely one of my favourite players, you know, to play for Essendon, definitely over the last 10 years. And I just a real, you know, to me, that's a failure of club management that he wanted to go somewhere else.
Well, I think what it indicates is, like, he strikes me as a guy who is a professional footballer first and foremost. He wants success. That's what he's looking for. That's why he came to the Bombers in the first place. You looked like you're on the way up. You had a list. And then after 3 years under Worsfold, he was like, this is not what I was promised. This was not what I came here for. On to the next one. Whereas Joe Danaher, it seemed to be more of a, look, you know, I don't want to cast aspersions, but it felt like he lost his enjoyment of football. I mean, he seemed to be a dude who genuinely loved being out there. He loved kicking a goal. Well, he loved kicking a goal and 8 points in a game. But he had a genuine enthusiasm. Yeah. But I think that you know, that Melbourne fishbowl and then all the attention that was on Essendon at the time, you could see that he was just... I think the Danaher name became, you know, a burden to him rather than, you know, something that he embraced. And then that moves trying to get to Sydney a couple of years ago, talking to Tom Harley, you just got the sense that, you know, you've got a professional footballer who wants his way out because he doesn't like what he sees. Then you've got a guy who's playing more in heart and he wants his way out of there as well. I mean, if you were John Worsfold or if you were the board, I guess, you'd look at what's going on at the coaching level and go, we're doing something wrong here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're both very different approaches to football that those guys have. But you have a feeling that if you had the right organisation, they would enjoy being a part of it and they would, you know, they'd stick with it. You know, it's funny. I've always felt that once a player indicates they want to go, it's over. Like, I just think I don't care how professional sports gets. If a player decides that they want out of a club and they want to be somewhere else, you got to cut them loose, spend the money on someone else. Like, you know, it's just an untenable situation. When Essendon fought to keep him at the club, I was like, what are you doing? Yeah. Like, what? He's not going to dig deep because he doesn't believe in the mission. You know, and I'm not saying that as to disparage him, but it's just like when someone decides they don't want to be there, if any employee in any company doesn't want to be there, they're not going to do their job well.
I mean, to me, it struck me as more of a point of pride from Dodorio. Like, he is the guy who drives a hard bargain. You know, they weren't happy with what the Swans were offering. They felt like, you know, he was, you know, 2 first-round draft picks at a minimum. Like, it seemed to get very, very murky. But I agree with you. Like, when a player, especially when a player's...
Well, that's it. Sorry, that then speaks to the failure of management, that winning a deal is more important than winning a game of football. And I'm sorry, it's not. Like, winning matches is what counts. I fuck them on a deal does not win a grand final. And no one at the end of the season, when they hold aloft the Premiership Cup, says, man, we fucked Sydney on that deal 2 years ago. Like, that's just not... Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that might be how he operates. But, like, you want people that want to win matches, not deals.
Yeah.
I mean, there you go. It's cop that. I don't really know what I'm talking about, but it felt good. I was in full flight.
It's weird. Like, I also wonder, you know, how does the player front up to the first season, you know, the first session of preseason training? Like, McRae at the Bulldogs last year pretty much did what Danaher did a couple of years ago, where he said, I don't like, you know, the culture of the club. I don't think they're working hard enough. I think there's people here who, you know, assume success is going to come. I want to go somewhere that's more aligned with my values. And the club fought tooth and nail to keep him because he is a good footballer. But, I mean, is that one of those honesty sessions that you hear about at a football club where the leadership group have to, like, then prove... I mean, it seems to me galling that Marcus Bontempelli has to then, like, prove himself to Jackson McRae. That doesn't make any sense to me.
No, that's exactly right. But how do you... A successful team, everyone will put themselves on the line for everyone else. Everyone... has everyone else's back ahead of their own well-being because they know that other people are there and have you know, you don't have to worry about you. If you've got everyone else's back, they'll have yours and that's, so let's go do it. Mm. If you know there's someone there that's just visiting,
yeah,
you know, like is a tourist to the experience of committing to the team. You can't. You just can't build that. You know, and that's once again those bad decisions that add up to not winning.
Mm.
You know, like you need. It's boring, but you need everything to go to be right. But the way everything goes right is you do it by the book. You don't make silly compromises like that.
Yeah.
Along the way, you need a team list that's 100% committed, and that's you know that's at the end of the day. Is a great cliche used by coaches, but I no. At the end of the day, the only thing that works is players actually caring about the team winning more than themselves. That's it. That's the only way you fucking get there. And you will have the superstars. You will absolutely have the superstars. But you watch Dusty Martin, you get the feeling he just fucking gives a shit about Richmond winning football games.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like you get a feeling that's why he gets out of bed in the morning. That's why he leaves his car under the MCG for months. It's because he just wants Richmond to win. Like, that's it. Like, he is just 100%, that's what he cares about. And you know, I don't know him. I don't know that much about him, but you get the sense that what he gives a fuck about is Richmond winning.
Football and getting tattoos seem to be his two number one things.
You got to have a hobby on your downtime, you know. Like,
well, when Waleed was on our grand final show last year, he told a story about Dustin Martin that I think is really telling. Where, you know, a few years ago when Dusty was kind of in the wilderness a bit, and GWS came a knocking, and so he went up there with his management team and did a tour of the facilities. And then when they sat down and sort of just had a chat with him, they said, you know, like, who are your best mates? And he was like, well, you know, well, Trent Cotchin and Jack Revolt. And they're like, you know, who are your greatest mentors? He's like, Damien Hardwick. And after a while, they're like, you don't want to come here. You may not realize it, but you like where you are. So we're going to do you a favor and we're going to say, stay with Richmond.
So I think I was definitely right in my, you know, I didn't hear that podcast, but I was definitely right on my profiling of Dusty Martin.
100%.
But, you know, and that's like, you know, like, back to that 93 Bombers side, Tim Watson came back to play so that there would be senior leadership.
Yeah.
You know, that's people that cared about the club winning.
Mm.
You know, Bomber Thompson wasn't exactly young at that point, but was committed. You know, like there was that absolute commitment to the team winning that makes the difference. You know, and it's the, you know, you have to draft well, you have to trade well, that's part of the game now. But it actually, it shows that no matter how well you trade and draft, that's not what wins.
Yeah. You know, normally...
you know, no one's ever said this before, but it just occurred to me that a team of champions will not always beat a champion team. You can write that down. That one's just for... It's an exclusive for Two Guys, One
There
Cup.
Is no I in team... But there is a team in team sport, and we are talking about sport. I think that's the metaphor. I'm not quite sure. I might have got a bit
yeah,
lost.
That's it. Definitely. Yeah.
Now, normally on these episodes, I ask people about what is the lowest point you know you've been at with your club. I think we've covered that extensively. What is
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Happiest memory? It doesn't have to be one of your grand finals. Is there a single game that you went to or a moment that is your happiest memory to do with the Bombers?
No, I know clear as... Clear as day, I know my happiest memory. And it was a 2000 grand final, but it was an exact moment. And it wasn't in the game, it was after the game. And I don't know if you remember this, but when Essendon lost to the Bulldogs during that season, so they won every game except the game against the Bulldogs. And it was about, there were about 10 matches to go in the season, I think, when they lost to the Bulldogs, or maybe 8 matches to go. And afterwards, they said, we don't sing the club song until we win the grand final. So, you know, after they won every game after that, they didn't sing the song in the rooms because the job wasn't done. And I'll never forget, they had just done their lap with the cup. You know, where they, you know, they walk around and I high-fived Mark McCurry down on the boundary. And they take the cup around and they do a lap. And then James Hurd grabs the cup and drags the team back to the centre circle. and puts it down in the middle of the center circle, and they stood around and they sang the club song for the first time in 10 weeks. And that was my favourite moment ever of Essendon, because it was, I mean, you can't beat the sense of narrative about it. It's like, if this is, you know, the movie Rudy, that's him playing his 15 seconds at the end of the game. But it's like, that's telling a story through action on a football field. And to me, that, like, there was a sense of, you know, and sure, he had a lot of weeks to think, oh, if we win, I'll do that. But as a fan, you didn't know that was going to happen. And it was just such an amazing crescendo to an incredible season. If you watch that grand final, I don't know if we've talked about this, but one of my other favourite things is they play old grand finals on the footy channel, and I was like three rows from the front for that game, and when Matthew Lloyd kicked a goal in the third quarter, I'm on camera saying number one. And so every time that is broadcast on Fox Footy, people tweet, is that you on the 2000 grand final coverage? And it's just like every single time it's on, and I just get reminded, and it's like, oh, what a great day that was. You know, like I get, like I have that little reminder. It's That's very amazing. Funny. I'm also sporting I'm sporting a terrible goatee that you would have known from our days living together. It was I did not look great.
But goatee.
Yes. Which I had no idea was so Brentish at the time. God, no one told me. At least I didn't have a soul patch.
Shannon Knoll.
Listening to
Shannon Knoll.
Shannon Knoll. No, who were they? Crazy Town.
Oh, wow.
At least I wasn't like, I have a soul patch cranking Crazy Town. Come, my lady. Come, my lady. You're my sugar pie. Oh, Jesus. I'm right back there. But yeah. That would be my favourite moment.
You know, you sort of spoke about the way you withdrew your membership in those couple of years after the peptide scandal. Do you think if for some reason, you know, the Essendon just ceased to exist, there was no men's team, there was no women's team, they just were a non-entity, do you think that you would continue to follow football?
It'd be harder. Like, it's, you know, I have great admiration for actually someone you should talk to, is Jared McCulloch, who I'm sure you would have.
Yeah, I see him at our local Catholic church about once a year. My last time I saw Jared McCulloch actually was when I was taking my mother to Christmas Mass, and we had a chat afterwards, and I was like, oh, I didn't know you lived in the area. And he's like, no, I drove out here because this priest, he does the best sermons.
Yeah, that is Jerry. Jerry is, so for those that don't know, Jerry, I think is, well, he's definitely one of the best comedy writers in Australian TV, and he has written for everything. Like, I first met him, he was writing for Full Frontal, which at the time was kind of the only TV writing gig going for comedy writers. But he was the head writer for Rove, he was the head writer for The Weekly for the first, like, five seasons of The Weekly. He's the head writer now for Hard Quiz. He is, like, so experienced. He was a writer for The Project. Like, he's, like, as experienced at writing for TV as anyone. So the reason I brought him up was he was a passionate Fitzroy supporter. And he's the only person I know who has had that experience of their club disappearing overnight. And, yes, they merged. Technically, they merged with the Bears. And, yes, he wears a Brisbane Lions jumper and supports the Lions. But I know that one of the greatest footy fans that ever lived, something died when his club did. And it's actually one of the things that it's one of the things I really like about AFL when you compare it to NFL, is that there can be a city with a team and then overnight that team is now in another city. And it just, you know, like a billionaire sells them to another city and that's it, you know, like, and you could have gone for a team your whole life and all of a sudden they're in Cleveland now. And it's just, you know, like one thing I like about Essendon, about the AFL is that it's still anchored in place. Like, no matter how professional it is, the fact that you have teams still today that are named after suburbs, not even cities, like they're named after suburbs, that is gorgeous. And I like the fact that, you know, you know, you mentioned the Western Bulldogs. They don't play there anymore, but I remember going to see them at the Western Oval. And I remember going to see St Kilda play in Moorabbin. And I remember going to Fitzroy. It's like one of the most beautiful football grounds that has ever existed is the Fitzroy football ground. And, you know, there is something so beautiful about the fact that that still exists within football, and I hope that never disappears. But that's a long and loquacious answer to your question, which is I don't reckon you could ever be as passionate about footy if your team disappeared. I just don't think it could ever be the same. Like, how about you? If St Kilda disappeared...
I mean, I oscillate in my thoughts on this because I ask this of every guest, and sometimes I think, yeah, of course I would, and then other times I'm like, but why? I've invested so heavily in this team, and it's more than just like wins and losses and, you know, going to the games. It's, you know, time spent with my father. It's time spent with my family. It's time spent with my friends. I don't know. I think, you know, the Jared McCulloch analogy is probably exactly right. I would have an interest because I love AFL. I think it's one of the best sports in the world, but I think that something inside me would be broken and I would not have the same passion. I would probably pick another team. Like I'd say, you know, I've spent a lot of time in New South Wales, maybe the Swans or GWS, you know, they're sort of closer to me, but I don't think I would follow. I mean, also I'm closer to death, Charlie, than I am, than I ever was when I started barracking for the Saints. So I don't have a lot of time left. So I think I would pick a team where I could see some immediate results. I can at least see a flag, but I don't know. I think that, I don't think I'd turn my back on the game altogether, but it would definitely be a long period of mourning.
Yeah, I don't think you overcome it. It's funny, you mentioned before, and I don't know if this is in now, but you've said to me before that we arbitrarily imbue, you know, teams with character, like we identify with them just out of choice. And it's really funny, like, you know, the times when you're at the football and you look around and you're surrounded by the supporters of your team and you're like, yeah, we're all together. And you go, I mean, if I met any of you on the street not wearing an Essendon scarf, I would be horrified, you know. and that's one of the beautiful things about football in general. But there's actually a psychological thing to it. And it's why I think football is really healthy and important. And it is that we all have within us, from thousands of years of evolution, in-group, out-group instincts. So we will fiercely see people within our group as us and people outside our group as them. Now, that manifests really badly in things like racism and sexism. Okay, like that's just, that's a bad manifestation. It takes work to overcome those core tribal instincts that lead to horrific outcomes like that. But football is a really healthy version of that. Like, you go, yeah, we're on a team and we hate those guys and we want to beat them because they're not us. Yet we walk outside and we all catch the same train home and we're not stabbing each other with spears. Do you know what I mean? Like, there is something that that's a healthy outlet of in-group, out-group mentality. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about football.
I think that's a great point to end the interview. Charlie, thank you so much for coming on to talk about the Bombers. All the best for 2021. See you later.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me. I have not talked about Essendon this long, well, since the peptide scandal. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, hopefully it was a bit more of a positive conversation. Thanks, Charlie.
It definitely was. Hey, thanks.
We are two guys, one cup.